Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, as usual, at our Reformed Forum headquarters. And this is episode number 845. I'm excited to be speaking today and to bring to everyone a wonderful guest for the very first time to the program. We're welcoming Aaron Wren, who is a writer and a consultant in Indianapolis and the author of a wonderful new book we're going to be talking today, Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. Welcome, Aaron. It's great to see you today.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a delight. It's a privilege. I've enjoyed reading your book and obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but I've been aware of your article and your thought for some time. It was introduced to me specifically by Daryl Hart, but he obviously was introduced to it, as many people were, through First Things, a very important article that you wrote there. But you've been writing for a long time on Substack and various places. You've co-founded or founded American Reformer, and you're a senior fellow there. I'd love for you to maybe explain a bit about what you do and introduce yourself to our audience, and then we can dive on into this wonderful book.
Sure. Well, I grew up in rural southern Indiana, was raised in a Pentecostal Assemblies of God culture war church there, went off to Indiana University, and then had essentially three careers. I started off as a management consultant for, 15, 18 years, much of that time spent in Chicago, working with Accenture. Then I transitioned to writing a lot about public policy, especially urban issues. It's been said that I love cities like only someone from a town of 29 people can. and so I ended up there in New York at the Manhattan Institute, did that for a while. And I actually still do some of that work as well. Mm. And then I pivoted again to my current work, which is really focused on the future of the evangelical church, and especially the ability to reach men. I actually got interested in this topic. I wasn't going to write on religion at all. It wasn't my plan. But I saw a decade ago, even before Jordan Peterson came around, that young men were turning to online influencers, but they were not turning to the church.
Right.
And why is that? And of course, now I can, if you tell people that, they get it, because there's huge people out there like Peterson, like Joe Rogan, like Jocko Willink, like infamous Andrew Tate. And I really wanted to help the church get in the game in reaching men, because I thought, the reality is there's just a lot of error when it comes to talking about gender issues in the church. And so that was sort of, and there's a whole chapter in the book on that. It might be the longest chapter in the book. Mm-hmm. I try to like spin people up on that topic. And then from there, I just sort of applying my analytical lens from consulting and policy analysis into the church. And, people thought it was useful. Again, I came up with this framework that was a huge hit, probably the biggest thing I've ever come up with. Mm-hmm. Turned into the book we're discussing today. And then, kind of in keeping with, my kind of urban, more intellectual orientation and work that I do, obviously I'm a Presbyterian today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's good. That's important. I'm finding a lot of touch points or intersections with your life, not that we've ever crossed paths directly. I also was from a small town.
Consulting projects in Deerfield and Mundelein.
Sure.
So not in Libertyville specifically, but I've been up there a lot.
We've got church members in Mundelein. I get over to Deerfield, and we're all over the place all the time. But a long time ago when I was graduating, I went to Bradley University, you may know, in Central Illinois, and then I did an MBA there. But at one point in time, I was at Accenture. Friends of mine had been hired there, but I did a round of interviews. But lo and behold,
if you don't know,
you interviewed me one time.
Shaheen, was it George Shaheen? He was the longtime managing partner of Accenture. He was a Bradley alum.
Oh, and I bet you his brother was a president at Caterpillar, Gary Shaheen.
Yeah, that was his brother. Yeah. He was a big shot at Cat.
Yeah, that's where
so
I worked.
So he we always recruited at Bradley a lot because obviously he was partial to Bradley.
Yeah, well, good stock there, So I ended up in Cat, not Accenture, but worked there for a long time, and Accenture, a lot of good folks there. that I've known over the years. So that's interesting. And also have an acquaintance, a friend of mine who does a lot of work for us here at Reform Forum, is married to a woman who works in development at Manhattan Institute. So
oh, nice.
Susanna. It's Ragusa now. So anyway, a little plug for her. So we'll throw her some business. So it's exciting to connect and talk about things that are particularly this day germane to the church and germane to our interests here at Reform Forum. Why don't you tell us, if you would, a bit about the story of this, you know, throwing these ideas out. I heard your interview or your discussion with Timon Klein on American Reformer about some of the background to this and how, you know, your three worlds idea, some people might have thought the genesis of that was with the First Things piece. But to me, it sounded like as you were recollecting this, you just kind of threw this out on a fledgling newsletter to begin with. How did this all start?
Yeah, so I originally started coming up with these ideas back in 2014, and I was watching a series of seven short films that my friend had helped produce called For the Life of the World. Mm. And it was playing at a Christian college and was very, very popular with Christian college students. And it talked about different, like, what is our salvation for? It was one of those kind of topics. And there were like different topics about money and love and different aspects of what it meant to be a Christian in the world. And I watched it. It's actually really good. And so I recommend it. It's really done well there. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I watched it, I said, you know, that was really good, but that is the film for 5 years ago. Mm. In the sense that the world is changing and this sort of engagement style is going to be, you know, obsolete in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I went home and I started making a whole bunch of bullet points of just observations that I had. And that was sort of the genesis of the three worlds model. I don't think it's any accident maybe that I picked 2014 as the inflection point for one of my transitions. And so I had this material. And then again, I started this newsletter. It was originally called The Masculinist. It was really focused on Christian men's issues. Again, I said, look, I felt obligated. It was one of these things where I didn't really want to start it, but I said, nobody else is talking about these things, so I feel obligated to at least try it. I said, I'll try it for a year, and if it sort of takes off virally, organically through word of mouth, I'll keep doing it. If it doesn't, I won't.
Sure.
And it got some decent pickup. You know, I had 200-300 people on the list, mm-hmm. but it wasn't going to hit the threshold I started to continue it. I said, well, you know, before I shut this thing down, I'll just throw out my two best ideas that have nothing to do with the topic of men's issues. One of which was the original piece. It was newsletter number 13 called The Lost World of American Evangelicalism. And then I actually made the decision to shut the thing down. I actually notified my charter subscribers I was done. I was moving on and trying to decide what I want to do next when somebody sent that to Rod Dreher. And he said, you got to check this out. Uh-huh. And so he sent me like 2,000-3,000 subscribers overnight, though then Doug Wilson picked it up. And it really went, I mean, again, this was in 2017. The piece went viral in 2017 mm-hmm. At the time. Then First Things Magazine asked me to update it for the magazine, and which I did. It was published in February 22. And then I essentially updated it for the book, Life in the Negative World, which about, you know, a quarter of the book is sort of an expanded and updated analysis of the world we live in, that kind of framework. And about three quarters of it is about, okay, how do we actually start responding and engaging to this new world that we're in?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about, a lot of interactions and other frameworks. This isn't trying to repeat any, but sometimes comes at things from a different angle, or we might even say orthogonally. There's a 10-cent word for you. But I'd love for you to sketch out for the people who might not know the framework or the understanding of these three worlds. We're speaking about the positive world, the neutral world, and now the negative world. Would you be able to, just for the sake of our new listeners and viewers, sketch out what those worlds are and roughly when they begin and end and why?
Happy to.
Thanks.
You know, we never had a state church like in Europe, mm-hmm. but there always was a sort of softly institutionalized generic Protestantism as the de facto national religion of the United States for most of our history. Mm-hmm. Even like as recently as the 1950s, you know, half of all adults attended church every Sunday. That was the high watermark of church attendance. We had prayer and Bible reading in the schools. We were adding under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, in God we trust, to our money. And there's a famous picture, you may have seen it, shared on social media periodically. It's the skyline of New York with windows in the skyscrapers lit up as big giant crosses for Easter. And that was in 1956. And in the 1960s, this all began to become unraveled. Christianity went into a period of decline that continues to the present day. So, you know, decline in terms of church attendance, decline in terms of personal adherence, and decline in terms of the questioning of Christian moral frameworks. And I divide that period of decline from 1964 to the present into three phases or worlds that I call the positive world, the neutral world, and the negative world. The positive world is from 1964 to 1994. And I want to be clear on something. This is not an era in which all is well for Christianity. Sure. This is a period of decline. Church attendance is going down, you know, sexual revolution, things are happening. At the same time, Christianity is still basically viewed positively in America.
Meaning if you're a good person or a good citizen, it's generally seen as a public benefit for you to be a church person, a Christian.
Right. If you're known as a good church-going man, that makes you seem like an upstanding member of society. And the there's that, and you know, the Christian moral norms are still the basic moral norms of society. And if you violate them, you could get into trouble. 1994, we had a tipping point and entered what I call the neutral world, where Christianity is not seen positively anymore, but it's not really seen negatively yet either. It's just one more lifestyle choice among many in a pluralistic public square. And again, this lasted from about 1994 to 2014. And so, you know, we might meet and I would say, I'm a Christian. And you would say, great, I'm a vegan. Let's talk. And you could have a, you know, conversation there.
Right.
Then in 2014, we had a second tipping point where, for the first time in the 400-year history of America, kind of official elite culture now views Christianity negatively or certainly at least skeptically. And again, you could go back throughout history and find leaders of our country, but the founding fathers, for example, many of them were not exactly like devout Christians, let's just say, but they felt obligated to hold it in public honor. Now, these people don't feel any need to do that anymore. And so to be known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job at Goldman Sachs or Google. Quite the opposite, in fact. Christian moral norms are now expressly repudiated. And in fact, you know, evangelicals now in some ways are seen as the leading threat to the new public moral order. And this has been a very dislocating experience, I think, for American evangelicals to enter this negative world.
Absolutely. One thing you mentioned here is Rodger's model of the Benedict option. You interact with it in the book. You have some good things to say and also some critique or looking at things from a different perspective. How does this interact with that model? Because that's another presentation, I think, that many people are familiar with of recent vintage.
Well, I benefited enormously from Rod's work in multiple ways. One of the ways is I got to see how everybody beat him up over his book.
Has that happened to you?
I could preemptively address all of their objections.
Sure.
And again, one of the things about writing an article in First Things is I could listen to how people critiqued that article or engaged with it and, you know, refine and update what I was doing. You know, I didn't hear anything that made me change my mind about the model. But there were some changes that I made to more clearly communicate, you know, what I was talking about. And so, you know, Rod, his Benedict option, I think, is very similar to what I'm talking about. I think there's a few differences. You know, one, you know, the evangelicals basically rejected the Benedict option. I don't know if you remember, but when it was published, Christianity Today magazine had a symposium where they asked four people to comment on the book. All four of them had significant critiques of the book. And so I think there's a few things going on there. One, Rod is Eastern Orthodox and formerly Catholic. He'd be the first person to tell you he has no clue about evangelicalism.
Yeah.
So I don't think he appreciated the extent to which something like monastic imagery would not play in the evangelical church.
The marketing issue. This is where Accenture could help with the messaging.
Yeah. Right. So that was one. I think secondly, he, you know, his book came out right as Trump won the election. And in fact, I think his book had originally been written with the assumption that Trump was going to lose the election. And he sort of had to make some, you know, kind of last minute modifications there.
Yeah.
And so I think the election of Donald Trump with 80% evangelical support made it seem like, hey, how can you claim things are bad for Christianity when you just pulled off the upset of the century and this big electoral victory for your boy?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Trumpism really sort of, you know, his book got sort of caught up in Trumpism. And then the third is, you know, a lot of people, I think, misunderstood what he was trying to get at with his imagery, like the monastery.
Mm-hmm.
It's about head for the hills, you know, run away, which was not what he was trying to say. But I tried to make extra special clear that's not what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But in essence, you could view my book maybe as an evangelical version of the Benedict option. I don't think it would be completely unfair to say that. That's what I would say.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed both books. And of course, I mean, people are going to have comments and criticisms and different ideas, especially when you take, you know, when you're vulnerable, but you're tossing out innovations, new thoughts, new ideas about things that are as big as creating Christian institutions to replace institutions that we've been party to for years and years and years. These are not things that are just going to fly without adjustment. This is big. These are big time ideas, and a lot of people are going to have different thoughts about them. One thing I was curious about, moving from the First Things article to the publication of the book, one thing you mentioned early on in the book, which if I haven't mentioned already, is published by Zondervan Reflective. Certainly want people to know that. You mentioned some tweaks or adjustments or improvements to the overall article, or perhaps clarifying some misunderstandings that readers have had. What are some of the more notable things that you adjusted between the article and this particular book, other than expanding the ideas?
Right. So one of the big ones was, you know, I originally just said the positive world was prior to 1994.
Mm.
And what I really wanted to dial in on was that the positive, I'm not, when I talk about the positive world, I'm not just referring to all of Christendom, where, you know, yes, you know, you could say Christianity was, the society was positive towards Christianity for long periods of time. And, you know, but that's not what I'm talking about. You know, and I really dialed it in. The positive world is the first phase of decline.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of put a start date on it of 1964. So that was an example of something that I changed. I also tried to address some of the, you know, objections people made that candidly I did not find particularly compelling.
Sure.
One of them, you know, was, well, it wasn't a positive world if you were a Black Christian, you know, in the 1950s. And, you know, you look at that and it's very obvious that for example, Black Americans were not being discriminated against because they were Christian. They were being discriminated against because they were Black.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is they could have rejected. They should have publicly started shouting, I am an atheist.
Mm.
And nothing would have changed for them. And this is still something that I think people do. Anytime you've experienced something bad or any sort of adverse outcome or experience, anytime somebody attacks you, that means you're experiencing a negative world.
Mm.
And I don't think that that's really what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is the way that official elite culture views and treats Christianity, right? The fact that, you know, if you're, you know, some sort of quasi-liberal pastor and you're getting attacked right. by fundamentalists, that does not mean you're experiencing a negative world.
Right.
It's, you know, so I think people want to like conflate, you know, anytime you've experienced something bad, it's a negative world. Or anytime, you know, society is not run entirely by Christian values, in accordance with Christian values, that also indicates that it must not have been a positive world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there's all these little things that I think people try to do. And I think at this point in time, by and large, people are not as interested in critiquing the model as such.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think, those are like a few things that people would say about sure. it that.
Well, I think it's useful for whatever adjustments there were. I think the book is sound. It holds together well. I think putting some some examples is helpful for readers, but also listeners. One example you use throughout the different worlds is talking about political scandals. You talk about a political candidate having an affair and getting found out prior to 1994. So from 64 to 94, that's going to destroy your candidacy. From 94 with President Clinton on up until 2014, you're going to have perhaps great damage. You're going to have to do a lot of control to maintain your place and your viability with the public, but it doesn't necessarily destroy your candidacy or your presidency. And then 2014 comes, and especially 2016 comes, we elect people that are, you know, just, I don't think I need to explain. There's a whole right. different way of viewing things, and evangelicals are willing to vote for such a person so long as they get other concessions. That to me was a very helpful, tangible example mm-hmm. here. Do you have others, or would you care to elaborate on that particular one?
Yeah, well, those, you know, I did use, you know, the one from the positive world I used was Gary Hart,
sure.
Who had to drop out of the presidential race in 1987 after it was reported that he'd had the young woman stay all night in his townhome. You know, and keep in mind, you know, it was a point of note that Ronald Reagan was the first president who had ever been divorced. I mean, it's like you think this is like, you know, we've always been kind of, you know, it hasn't always been like France here, you know, where, you know, you assume the guy's got a mistress on the side or something like that. And so, yeah, there's definitely things there, you know, and I say, you know, there's a lot of ways that we can think about the profound changes in society that result from kind of the negative world. And again, you know, if I had it to do over again, writing the book, I would probably elaborate even more on some of these. I talk about it on Twitter a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and different things that are happening. But like one thing I mentioned in the book is, you know, Donald Trump is a product of the negative world. Mm. He talked about running for president for like 30 years and he never pulled the trigger. Why? Because I think he understood he was not electable. You know, he may have like run on the Reform Party campaign, but he wasn't a serious candidate. So the point being that he understood that the rules had fundamentally changed in society. And that's why he could come down that escalator. Yeah. Because all of the things that would have previously disqualified him no longer held any weight in society. And I think there's a great irony that it was, you know, the people who tore down all the standards, all the guardrails that had previously governed society are the most horrified by Trump and now want to invoke many of those old standards against him. And they can't because there are no more standards anymore. But let me give you a couple of some examples that aren't in the book.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, the way that essentially vice has been completely legitimized and normalized in our society. So gambling has metastasized everywhere. You know, I think Indiana legalized its state lottery in the early 1990s, somewhere in the 1990s. And it was like controversial to amend the state constitution to permit gambling. A lot of religious groups opposed it. Well, you know, now today, you know, Indiana, which you think of as a red state, is completely in the pockets of the gambling companies. You know, they've got gambling on your phone, sports betting everywhere.
ESPN just bought, I mean, they just on major mass market television, there's just straight up ads and suggestions on who to bet for.
And it's the major sports leagues and who were previously extremely allergic to gambling, you know, colleges even, and what you think of as the most kind of clean cut all American athletes like Peyton and Eli Manning are all flogging gambling. The drug legalization, pot legalization, psychedelics legalization, the normalization of taking drugs and saying we just need to like let people be drugged up all the time. You know, is a good example. You know, essentially legalized loan sharking. We got payday loan stores on every corner. We used to have usury laws in America that protected consumers against excessive interest charges and other things. You know, now you know, greed is good. And so every practice that you used to have to go to shady characters like the mob for, you know, is now a completely legitimate multi-billion dollar business. It's again loan sharking, it's the sex trade, it's drugs, it's gambling, You know, we got it all. You don't need to, I don't know what the mob is doing these days. It's like, you know,
they're
now
legitimate.
That it's all legal. Like, what's left? What's left for the mob to do? Let's be honest. And again, this is part of a result of, you know, the kind of the decline, again, the decline of any Christian moral
sure.
standard. It's like, it's okay if we promote things that, you know, destroy many people's lives, have many socially toxic effects, as long as, you know, you and your, you know, me and my buddies can make a whole lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the stone cold reality of the situation.
I think as a person who spent some time in Chicago, you'd appreciate this. I think I was watching a documentary about Mike Madigan. He used to be a Speaker of the House here, a notorious Chicago politician.
Yeah. Madiganistan.
Iron Mike would never talk on the phone. That tells you a bit about what the only meetings he would have would be in his office, which had been swept, and, you know, never went anywhere else for meetings and never talked on the phone. But I don't think it was actually said in the documentary, but my conclusion to this, because I've had some other experiences. One, I got burglarized when I was in seminary. And the crook eventually got caught because he stole the neighbor's checkbook and was writing himself checks. So I think the level one criminal is stupid and they get caught because they're not intelligent. But I think a level two criminal, the really intelligent ones never get caught or very rarely get caught. But the level three criminal, they make their crimes legal. And I think that
exactly.
And I think that's what you have with the mob and with all these other people. What used to be and viewed as a crime or very bad, you know, vices, culture has shifted such that it's acceptable now. And it's, you know, it's for profit. It's a good thing. It's celebrated. I mean, all of in Europe, all of the football teams, soccer teams, I mean, all of them, almost at least half of them, they're either airlines or sports betting companies. But that's not just Europe. It's bled over here. What do you think precipitated this? You do mention some flexibility on the date in 2014. In terms of identifying when the negative world really begins, and it could be a year or two before, a year or two later. What are some of the events that at least factor into that transition?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's very clear something big shifted in the culture during President Obama's second term.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously there was a huge flip on sexuality. You know, in 2008, California, the bluest state in America, passed a popular vote referendum to ban gay marriage in its constitution. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama ran for presidents as opponents of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama even cited his Christian faith as the reason. Now, he was lying. He had been on record as a supporter of gay marriage in the 90s when he was a state legislator in Illinois.
Yeah.
But he felt compelled to lie when he was running for president.
And that's a point in itself. That's evidence right there that he had to lie to make his
then,
campaign work.
You know, 2015 was the Obergefell decision that legalized gay marriage. And of course, today, the skirmish line of the culture war, if you want to call it that, is whether there can be transgender athletes in girls' sports. That is quite a sea change in a very short period of time. There's also the so-called Great Awakening,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, Matthew Iglesias, the leftist pundit, he co-founded Vox, the website Vox. He dated that, started that to 2014. And again, it was probably somewhat triggered or initially kind of triggered by a Trayvon Martin killing in 2012. And around that time, you know, the use of terms like white supremacy and structural racism started to soar, just like hockey stick up in major publications. And I think the key is this predated Trump. This was not a reaction to Trump. This predated Trump. And so that's going on in the culture at this time. And of course, had a massive influence, I think, on the church as well. And then, you know, Jonathan Haidt, the NYU professor, he wrote The Righteous Mind, I think. He's, you know, really well-known public intellectual.
Mm.
He has said that it was 2013 when things started to go crazy on campuses.
Mm.
In America. So there was clearly something of a leftward lurch in the culture circa 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the reason's complex. You know, I don't really know exactly why did this happen. People always want to know, why did this happen? You know, I don't know why it happened. You know,
but
all these
did.
People like to go back, you know, like Rod Dreher, where did it all go wrong? William of Ockham in the 12th century. Yeah, he didn't invent that, you know, but that's like one, you know, you know, a lot of Catholics say it all went wrong with the Reformation or the Enlightenment's where it all went wrong.
Sure.
Where did it all go wrong? I don't subscribe to the where did it all go wrong. This was clearly a somewhat contingent outworking of very complex forces that have been ongoing for centuries and outworking through, you know, percolating their way through. But it definitely happened.
It did. Yeah. This is the world we're living in. And whether we like it or not, we have to reckon with it. Now, the church obviously has dealt with persecution in the past, but we're living in a world that's different than it's ever has been. I'm not willing to say, and I don't think you are either, to say it's worse than it's ever been. But certainly the church has new challenges to deal with. And you devote quite a bit of space within this book,
right,
talking about practical strategies, both for persons, but also for the church, in how to deal with this world. What are some things that you suggest that we can implement to brace ourselves, but protect ourselves from cancel culture and perhaps, you know, economic sanctions or whatever it may be, being ostracized, not just in terms of reputation, but in terms of livelihood?
Sure. I think, you know, there's a lot in there, and I don't have time to go through it today, but kind of three things. You got to buy the book. Three things I would highlight are, you know, adopting a posture of exploration would be one. Second would be shifting away from a mindset of relevance and transformation to a counterculture. And then third would be remaining potentially engaged politically, culturally, socially.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the culture of exploration, I would contrast with a management or business plan approach. So you take a guy like Bill Hybels, who started Willow Creek Church there in suburban Chicago.
Yeah, not far away.
The legend of the church, you know, the kind of the origin story is in the 1970s, he goes door to door in suburban Chicago asking people why they don't go to church. And as he said, he got an earful. And so he designed a church that they would like.
It's market research. Yeah.
I don't think, you know, that kind of approach is going to work today. I think we're in a more fundamentally unknown situation. Also, you know, we're in such a dynamic world. There's so many things we just, you know, Trump, pandemic, wars, the world is like changing rapidly. And so we need to adopt less of a business plan, business strategy. There's no 50-point plan to figure this out. We need to think like an explorer. Think like the Lewis and Clark guys going out into Louisiana Purchase to see what's there. The analogy I give is the Israelites crossing the Jordan River into the Promised Land after having spent their entire life in the wilderness. And again, however, you know, bad the wilderness may have been in some, you know, point, it was familiar, had some nice things, you know, manna showed up every morning.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're going into the unknown. And there's the line from Joshua, follow the ark because you've never been this way before. And I think that's where we're going. We're going into the unknown territory. So we have to be more comfortable walking by faith than by sight. I think that mindset is very important. We also need to, shift towards being more of a counterculture. You know, I think a lot of the models have been, and I'm drawing on some work from Tim Keller here, you know, I don't need to go into all the details on it, but basically like seeker sensitivity or the cultural engagement models of the cities, they were essentially focused on trying to be relevant to people's lives, cultural concerns, lower the boundary to get people in the door, things of that nature. And of course, you might say the culture war, they were very focused on transformation. They wanted to use politics to, you know, kind of transform the country to be more aligned with sort of God's laws, if you will. And like, as we go into this negative world and you're a moral minority, not a moral majority, you need to think more about being a counterculture and about how to self-consciously steward your own community identity and strength to transmit your values to your children and grandchildren in this environment, something that evangelicals have not as much had to think about to do because the culture, even if it wasn't Christian in a sense, nevertheless, sort of buttressed many, many things, you know? And so, you know, you can't rely on the schools. Not only there's not prayer in school, you can't rely on the schools to basically reinforce the Christian moral system, for example. And the standards of society, we just talked about a lot of them, I think are completely different from how, you know, a Christian community would aspire to live. So we need to, we need to look to people like the early 20th century Catholics who lived in essentially an anti-Catholic country and said, if we want to remain faithful Catholics in America, we have to create schools, universities, fraternal societies, infrastructure, networks, practices to demarcate and sustain community life. Evangelicals have been way too dependent on mainstream institutions. And now that those institutions are really no longer Christian, we have to create our own infrastructure mm-hmm. and tend to our own community strength, not as a substitute for mission, but as a home base for mission mm-hmm. and to have a place to invite people into. And then the last thing I'll highlight is to remain prudentially engaged. When you become a moral minority, what has been the approaches people have taken? I think there's kind of been two. A lot of the culture war people have sort of said, well, we need to double down and take the gloves off, become a little more Machiavellian, if you will. And I think this is sort of the rationale supporting Trump, other things of that nature.
Yeah. Muscular approach.
I think one, this does not take great stock of a couple of things. The first is that I think it implicitly believes that the previous generations of culture warriors simply weren't serious, didn't fight as hard as they might want. In fact, if you go back to the early culture war era of the 70s and 80s, they talk identically to people today. We don't want to conserve anything. We want to have a revolution. That exact language is right there. Secondly, that agenda is not popular with the public. And we see, for example, that every time it goes to a vote, pro-abortion position wins.
Sure.
What are you going to do about that?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they've quite taken stock of that. On the other hand, you have a large number of people. They tend to be the more urban, affluent, label cultural engagement Christians, are promoting essentially disarmament, political disengagement. They've adopted a sort of an Anabaptist inflected approach. And they'll say things like, our citizenship is in heaven, not in the United States of America. We lose down here. Jesus didn't come to exercise power. Jesus came to give up power. So they talk this way. And the idea is to essentially stand down and abandon the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, they don't really mean that because they always give an exception for their causes. they'll label something like racial justice a gospel issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when they call something a gospel issue, that means that advice doesn't apply. So we can decide what things we want to be very loud and proud about. We'll be out there putting it, but like you guys over there are wrong. So they're very, very, I don't have any respect at all for that position, mm-hmm. The way that they implement it. And the second one is, you might not care about politics, but politics is interested in you. And, evangelicals are a large group of people and are going to be in positions of authority in our society, in business. It might be an evangelical governor like Bill Lee of Tennessee.
Mm.
And I believe even Glenn Youngkin of Virginia is an evangelical. So they need to be equipped to actually exercise their power well and wisely in the context they're in. And so what I say is to remain prudentially engaged. Don't withdraw. Don't abandon politics. Don't abandon culture. At the same time, we have to be wise about where we are and those sorts of things.
I think we certainly have to have that pilgrim mentality. I mean, the Hebrews 3 and 4 and the New Testament, I believe, definitely presents the church as a pilgrim people. But I think that's one in which the church ought to also constantly be living out their faith and engaged in the Great Commission. So I appreciate the way you present that, because a totally escapist model is not, I think, taking stock of the entire New Testament ethic. It's emphasizing one part of it, but not the whole.
There's a lot of different models in the Bible. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all.
No.
And I think that what we end up with is we tend to overemphasize one particular model to the exclusion of all the rest.
Mm.
So, for example, John the Baptist, spoke truth to power very aggressively and got killed for it. So that was one that might suggest that the way that you should operate is like the Hebrew prophets.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely bold denunciations, regardless of the cultural conditions, and being willing to accept martyrdom for that. So that's one, and that's a legitimate register. You look at Paul, he didn't do that. Paul tried to actually, treat the governing officials with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at most of his commands, they're about, hey, pay taxes to whom taxes are due, things of that nature. And, you know, he's like, oh, you're the high priest. I did not know that.
Exactly.
I wouldn't have talked to you that way. He
yeah,
does
exactly.
these things. You know, trouble found him. He
right.
wasn't afraid to be bold in the gospel, but he wasn't out there deliberately picking fights with people.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to Mars Hill and he's like, well, guys, let me tell you about, you know, what's going on. It's like, you're all going to hell. You need to repent. Now, it was just a different way of talking about the world. And so I think there are these different ways that people have done it. And just the kind of the one size fits all, the idea that there's like some simple little mm-hmm. formula. I can just pick these things out. This is what we're supposed to do. Are there, it's good. You know, it's good to be a prophet, you know, in a sense, in that sort of sense. But, you know, the reality is the prophets were a very tiny group of people. Most people were not prophets. You know, so I think that those are things that we need to, and one of the things I emphasize in the book is like, people are going to come to different good faith ideas about what prudential engagement means today.
Sure.
And so we need to, you know, we need to like accept that. I think there has been a tendency to try to call people names if they're not doing what we want. I think there's a place for saying that guy over there has got it wrong. So I don't think we should have to, you know, we're going to have, it's wrong to have debates.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think we need to recognize that some people just have, you know, good faith disagreements.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, you know, maybe they're compromisers, other people, you know, maybe whatever. But not everybody's going to come to the same conclusion and not everybody's in the same place.
Mm-hmm. One thing I appreciate in the book is the way you think about this comprehensively and thinking about how Christians can navigate and live and engage with the negative world. You even have some thoughts and comments about economic, you know, business ideas, about living in digital spaces. I'm taking a little bit of a shot in the dark here, but have you ever heard of a guy named Balaji Srinivasan? He was involved.
Yeah, I know exactly who he is.
With The Network State? Are you aware of his book, The Network State?
I haven't read The Network State, but I know him.
Well, wonderful. So his book is available. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. He's, because he wants to get his ideas out, he has the book for sale, but he also has it entirely online at thenetworkstate.com. You can also just download a PDF. It's out there for a lot of people, partly because it's based on some very advanced cryptography and other decentralized ideas that some people cast off to the side because there's a lot of con artists in that space as well. So I'm definitely a fan of and a believer of the underlying technology of blockchain technology, all that stuff. We don't need to go into that. Even though there are a bunch of bad actors messing with that stuff too, the technology is quite interesting and sound, but he's advocating for this idea of presenting, trying to get through our polarization in our present society by allowing people to realign according to affinities. And there's a lot of application there potentially for Christians to. He starts advocating very small, just having little, you know, online networks. But eventually, if you can do all these sorts of things through blockchains, you can eventually create your own little tiny sub-economies, maybe raise enough capital and buy a plot of land. And you start to think about like Hasidic Jews and the way they congregate and how they've lived and taken over various neighborhoods of New York. Or you could eventually, he goes the whole way and eventually says, yeah, eventually you can potentially be recognized as a nation by the United Nations. If you got an economy of $1 billion or $2, why couldn't you? It's a wild idea, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or comments, because I thought at least some of his ideas intersect with some of the things that you present within your book.
One of the things I love about the Silicon Valley guys is their willingness to fundamentally rethink futures.
Sure.
And I have used blockchain as a metaphor for the kinds of institutions that we ought to be trying to build in the future, which are like, not maybe rather than traditional institutions, we should think about blockchain institutions. And that's not a like saying that our institutions should literally be based on blockchain.
Mm.
But the idea is that blockchain provides a completely decentralized,
yeah,
a different way of organizing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I would say is the fundamental premise of blockchain is trustlessness.
Right.
That is to say, it's all based on cryptography and mathematics. Therefore, you don't actually have to trust your counterparty.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike traditional transactions, I do not think we want to be going in a low trust direction for the church. I think that we need to be building higher trust networks, and that in a society where trust is in decline, scams are going rampant, having high trust relationships to call on is going to be critical. What I do think, and again, this is not in the book, it's a little bit, you know, maybe getting down in the weeds here.
Sure.
Is new forms of organizations that reduce legibility. Which is interesting. And I wrote about this. There's a very famous book. I think the guy's name is James C. Scott. It's called Seeing Like a State. It's a sort of a libertarianist book. But this guy talks about, you know, one of the things that governments want to do is to make everything legible. So in medieval society, land tenure wasn't necessarily written down. All the rules about land use were essentially based on custom. And there were no standardized ways in which those sort of land use things, it could be anything. You know, there could be a custom around anything. And gradually over time, the governments wanted to create centralized land registries, standardize the rights, the various bundle of rights that are held in land. Why do they want to do that? Because they want to tax it.
Sure.
And they want to be able to, it's very easy. It's easy to tax when you have that sort of thing. So legibility is the key to seeing like a state. And so if you create a traditional organization, like a nonprofit, you're now very legible to the state. You're very legible to society. It's very easy to zap somebody for being a member of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an actual member of an actual organization, you get zapped. What you look at in, say, China, when you're in a society that's very hostile, much more hostile than in the United States, certainly we don't. I make clear in the book, don't compare us to places like China. It's very But in China, where the church is suppressed, many people are in house churches.
Yeah.
They're informal gatherings. House church is illegible. Nobody knows that your house church exists. It doesn't have legal personality. It may not have a bank account. You know, it doesn't have a staff.
Mm-hmm.
You're just in a house church situation. And so I'm not necessarily advocating house churches, but it's an example of an organization that is less legible. And, you know, things of that nature. So thinking about new forms of organization, maybe based on informal networks of high trust, could be something that's,
promising.
You know, yeah. Something to look at. So I think the blockchain is a metaphor for how to rethink organization is key.
Mm-hmm.
Although obviously, you know, of course, you know, Balaji is really into the whole idea of like basically seceding.
Sure, sure.
basically, the tech guys are very secessionist.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, they're very big into seasteading and charter cities. They want to achieve full sovereignty for their state,
mm-hmm.
which is unlikely to happen. And, you know, may not be good for society. You know, if it did, you could read the cyberpunk literature.
Yeah, exactly. Know, it started sort of back then.
Dystopian futures in which corporations have achieved extraterritorial status and essentially run the world and governments are depowered. And, you know, there's a lot of them that sort of have this kind of idea, which I think is a little outre. But nevertheless, rethinking, you know, why can't we be more inventive about it? I think we should be thinking that kind of way.
Sure. And it's a way for us to also think tangentially to orthogonally. I'm throwing all these goofy ideas out, but or the words out. I apologize to the listeners. But we can make ourselves more robust, less cancelable, as you mentioned from Nassim Taleb. We make ourselves anti-fragile, not just robust, but better than robust. Anti-fragile, there are ways that you can think about your economic livelihood for one, but also the way we organize, the way we engage in institutions, our education, our rights. There are all sorts of other ways I think as Christians, we should be proactive and not only reactive, where we're thinking about these things in advance and whether or not we're going to end up in the dystopian society of cyberpunk literature is really beside the point, but if we're preparing for it, then I think we're in a better place and more useful potentially in the long term. Do you have any final remarks or anything you'd like to say to our listeners or viewers while we have you still on the line before we got to go?
No, this has been great. Okay. Just, be sure to sign up for my newsletter, aaronwren.com. Go there, sign up. It's free to get on the list. Almost everything's free. And then be sure to buy the book.
Tell us a bit. We're absolutely going to be promoting that, but tell us a bit if you might give a pitch also for American Reformer, because I listen to you guys in the podcast, read the articles. What do you have going on?
Yeah. American Reformer is a nonprofit seeking to reinvigorate Protestantism in American cultural, social, political life. And so we have a journal, the American Reformer Journal at AmericanReformer.org. We have a center looking at Christian higher education, a center for academic faithfulness and flourishing. We do reform work where we partner with stakeholders and institutions to help them adapt to the negative world, maybe correct them where they're going in wrong directions. We have a fellowship program for young people and a lot of stuff going on. And part of this, part of American Reformer, the need came from the fact that, when I wanted to start my work, I realized there's no good institution to do my work at. What institution, is going to political conservatism has no interest in sort of evangelical writing and scholarship. Let's be honest. It's super Catholic, for one thing. Yeah. Mostly Catholic and Jewish. Evangelicals are supposed to shut up and just vote the way they're told. Basically, it's maybe not much of an exaggeration, I hate to say.
We don't demand much, as you mentioned in the book. We need to demand more.
And then I realized, I don't think it's any accident that my article on the Three Worlds of Evangelicals was published at First Things, which is ecumenical, but, basically I think perceived as a Catholic journal. Certainly has Catholic editor, has always had a Catholic editor. And, there's not really great outlets or writing of this type in the evangelical world, because many of the existing organizations and publications are sort of aligned with particular tribes and particular point of views, that in my view are somewhat wedded to the old models of the positive and the neutral world. And so American Reformer is the place that's trying to, build out an institutional infrastructure to really think about things from an authentically negative world perspective. And, you could check them out. Again, I don't agree personally with everything that's published on American Reformer, neither does anybody else.
That's good.
But there's a lot, but there's so much interesting stuff. I think there, some of it scholarly, some of it, I'm not a scholar, some of it might be, more like stuff I would write,
reacting to the news.
Be sure to check it out.
We certainly will put a link to that in the episode description as well. As Aaron said, AmericanReformer.org. A lot of interesting stuff there. And check out Aaron Wren. That's AaronRenn.com. And subscribe to the email newsletter. Aaron also has a podcast, his own, The Aaron Wren Show, which is very useful. He talks to various guests and lots of interesting subjects. But most of all, check out the book, Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. It's out now. It's a bestseller. You can find it all over the place. It's published by Zondervan Reflective, and it's a tremendous book. Thanks so much for joining me today, Aaron. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take a look at online at reformedforum.org for information about all of our upcoming events, our publications, and our other episodes. And I do want to thank everybody for listening and for watching. And we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.